Accession number 27804, Squadron Leader Ian Blair, Real 16. Now, what happens? You do the course from November to December on the Tiger Moth. What happens then?
I'm just going to say, the flying course lasted from, as I said, from the actual flying from November the 15th right through to December the 30th. And at the end of the course, I had done a total of 51 hours on a Tiger Moth, which included 23 and a half hours solo, and I flew a Gypsy Moth, which was a different, while I was on the course, I flew a Gypsy Moth, which is a different, it's still a moth, but the engine's outside, you know, exposed.
Was it any better or different?
Pardon?
Was it any...
No, it was just a bit more clumsy, different speeds.
So what happened next?
It took me 6 hours and 10 minutes to go solo out of that, so it was average. And we did a bit of blind flying.
Now what's blind flying?
Flying on instruments only. I see here that I had 2 hours and 10 minutes. It must have had a hood. I must have had a hood on the aircraft. Can't remember actually. And I did 5 hours on the Link Trainer, which is the old-fashioned synthetic.
Tell me a bit about the Link Trainer.
Well, Link Trainer was the forerunner of all simulators, they call them nowadays. It was a shortened type of fuselage, but it was just a box mounted on a set of bellows with a hood. So when you got and standard blind flying panel and controls, throttle and joystick. So when you put the hood down, you were complete. You only had your instrumentation, and this was the movements of the Link Trainer were conveyed by electronic means to a thing called a crab, which was a triangular device which stood about 6 inches off a table, and it had a pointer on it, and the crab, which literally crawled across the table in the direction you were going, and if you made a turn, the crab turned as well. And they could plot your courses on a map, if you will. But your instrumentation was there, and you got some sensation. There was no noise. You got some sensation because you are blacked out. You have only got your instruments. You don't know which way you are up. And it taught you to read your instruments and keep the right way up. And if you got in a situation and you stalled the aircraft through misreading the instruments, it spun. You know, you just went round on it. But that was the initial. There aren't very many.
How realistic was it, would you say?
We didn't know any better, really, in these days. It was as realistic as one would expect, I suppose, basically. Nobody liked doing it because you were closeted in this darkness. But it became a way of life, as far as pilots was concerned. You couldn't get by. Well, you can't get by without them nowadays. But it was just another means of saving expensive airtime in teaching pilots to fly by instruments. Mind you, bearing in these days, they were very basic, but they improved. But that exercise terminated on the December the 30th, and the next phase was posting to SFTS, Service Flying Training School. And my lot was, the course, all of us that passed, went to 4FTS. Now, 4FTS exists today. It's famous in the annals of the Royal Air Force. Even Churchill knew about 4FTS, and we were mentioned in Churchill's dispatches when we were involved in the war, inverted commas, in Iraq in the early 40s, the Rashid Ali revolution. And Churchill did make a statement which went something like, if it had not been for the spirited defence of Royal Air Force Albania by No. 4 FTS, then the Germans would have marched through into Iraq and Iran and taken over the oil.
That's running that ahead a bit. But so we'll what happened when you we'll got there in January, did you?
We'll come to that in a minute.
We'll come to that.
But so having got there, the next phase of the exercise, we were all posted to 4 FTS, which was in outside 60 miles outside of Basra. Now, we were down in the Nairobi. We had to get on a train. I think if I remember correctly, we were on this train for about 4 days going north to Khartoum. I think we went to Khartoum, yes. Went north to Khartoum, I believe. I think it was Khartoum. Well, took us about 4 days with our unexpired portion, it's the rations, and all we went off on this northbound train. And we got to Nairobi, we got to Khartoum. We were put aboard an Isle steamer, which was a stern paddle wheel steamer. a bit out of the Western, but anyway, we were out on this old paddle steamer and we chuntered up the Nile, down the Nile to Cairo. That took about 2 days. Took us a while, actually. Having got there, we were disembarked in Cairo. The thing I remember about the Nile steamer was all these young boys, wallids, what do you call them? Yeah, they had made in canoes, inverted commas, from 4 gallon flimsy petrol cans, and they were paddling out and trying to flog knickknacks to us on the ship. But all the way up the Nile, this happened right up to Cairo. Bum boys, they call them. Bum boys. Yeah, but then, and the gilly man, he was the conjurer. He always came aboard with the 3 cups and a chicken. The 3 coconuts. Find the chicken. That type of thing we experienced, all trying to sell us trinkets. However, we got to Cairo. Can't remember how long we were, but from Cairo we went to, we must have gone up by train to, from Cairo we went up the edge of the canal to a place called El Arish, which was a crossing at the northern end of the canal. It was a ferry crossing, must have been. And this particular time we arrived there, it was night time, beautiful, cloudless, brilliant moon. Remember, we got to the crossing, and the air raid siren went, so we all ducked to cover, we all had to take cover, and there was a Ju-52 came across and dropped a few bombs on this crossing, which didn't do us any harm, but we all took cover, nevertheless. We then boarded this Nairn Transport Company. I think it became quite famous. It was a single-decker Mercedes diesel engine bus. The air conditioning, which didn't work. And this bus was part of the Nairn Transport, which ran a bus service across the desert from El Arish to Baghdad. Well, I think it took us about 36 hours. Terrible journey, because there's no roads. Your journey across the desert, day and night, was following the 45-gallon drums painted and battered and rusting, which only the driver literally knew the way. Anyway, it was very uncomfortable. We still had our unexpired portion, no water, very little water, stifling hot, no air conditioning, covered in dust, covered in sand. And eventually, some 36 hours later, we arrived at Area for Banya. I think the bus went there. I'm not quite sure how we got from Baghdad to Baha. But we obviously got there. But we were. So here we are, all 18 or 24. By this time, well, there was 18 of us from Kenya. But this time I had lost my acting sergeant, so I had to revert to corporal. So I was a senior man with all these LACs. I was wearing my air gunner's badge, brevi, which I was entitled to, and I had my gong up, which nobody had ever seen before. That's another story. I'll come to that in a minute. But anyway, we duly got to Baghdad, and we eventually finished up on the camp. Now, if I describe...
Well, yeah, because Habania is quite well known. But it's a weird place to be, really.
Habania, a little bit of background. Habania is well acknowledged. It was a custom-built airfield. It was built on recovered ground, which is below the level of the Euphrates, a desert level playing field. And round the perimeter of the camp was what we called the Bund, which is a great big dike in anybody's. So if the river overflowed, we were likely to get flooded. Suffice to say, the design of the camp took into consideration that fat feature. So you had this monumental airfield, you had four permanent hangars, and you had numerous workshop buildings. But the thing that impressed me, all the roads were straight and avenues were straight, and they all had frightfully British names like Piccadilly Circus and that type of thing. There were 12,500 civilian employees within this perimeter. They were in the village which was built to house them. And they were self-supporting in this village, but the whole area, which had the Euphrates on one boundary and the desert on the other three boundaries, it's not far north of this current place called Fallujah, which is about 5 or 6 miles away. But the camp was built in about 1935, or was started in 1935, and it was occupied, I think, in the early 1938 period. It withdrew the RAF units from Mosul in the north and some other units. So they all came under the one airfield. They had an air headquarters there and at least one hospital, if not more. It had a small shopping area open to the troops within the boundaries. There was no runways then. The actual airfield we had it surrounded by a domestic site, was surrounded by a big fence. And to get onto the airfield, you had to open these gates, big gates, to let the aircraft taxi into the airfield. They're taking off strip. The roads, as I said, all the flowers and the shrubbery were all imported. Indigenous to UK, they were all done this. They did this on purpose. And right in the middle of the camp, we had a big naffy store. And I think there was there was some form of water station. It was a big water tower, but the purification plant. That's what it was. That was in the middle of the camp. And the pumping stations, which served the sewage units, were in a village of Fallujah, which I said 5 miles away. I'll come to that in a minute because it's important. But there was a contingent of civilian employees with the Iraqi Air Force. They were instructors and technicians, and there was a big contingent of civil people working in the embassy in Baghdad itself. The Baghdad embassy had a wireless transmission station, which you could communicate with the air headquarters. Now, the whole of the airfield, which is we called it an intermediate, it was, you have to see it, it had dozens of tennis courts, it had a polo pitch. You just imagine, it had a race course all within the perimeter. And there was a big wireless transmitting station within the perimeter as well. These were a little bit remote. Station headquarters was a typical station headquarters for that period. It was a brick building, but outside the station headquarters was the usual ornamental gardens, which were kept immaculate by the local gardeners. But this is important, that the outside station headquarters where the ensign was put, there were two 4.5 howitzers, gun howitzers, which had been used in the 1914-18 war, and they were immaculately painted in white and black, and the boss, which was in the barrel, was had an RAF crest on it, was highly burnished. These two guns have a history, which I'll come to subsequently. So anyway, that's sort of general. The billets were, they weren't air conditioned, but they had fans. We had single billets.
Huts.
Huts. Open hut with verandas and fly nets and things like that. And fans going. And then each room in each hut had their own punkawala, the guy who kept the room neat and tidy and brought the tea at first thing in the morning, that type of thing. We had a permanent mess hall, and we had a permanent instructional block for school. The mess hall was absolutely fantastic. I've never had food like it. Here you are stuck out in the middle of the desert when it's 180 in the shade and literally no shade. The food these guys used to serve up was really out of this world.
In what way? What was so good about it?
It was just first-class meals, regardless of what you had. It was beautifully done. You have to see it to believe it. It was really living par excellence, really.
Was it an English diet, or was it mixed Iraqi-style vegetables?
No, it was British food. Yeah, that was beautiful. We had two swimming pools, big swimming pools. We had the cinema, open air cinema, at least two, and then we had the hospital. But it's a colossal. I think if I remember, it covers 9 acres or some quite. But however, having said all that, the flying 4 FTS was in fact split into two parts. This is the intermediate flying training system. You've done your basic on your Tiger Moths, so you're now capable of flying solo in a Tiger Moth. So you're now being introduced to the next stage up, the intermediate stage.
Now what did that involve? Flying,
pardon?
What did that involve?
Well, that was flying bigger aeroplanes of a military nature. Now, the flying training school was broken down into a single-engine component and the multi-engine component. By that, I mean the students were split into those who were capable of flying single, those who were more suitable for fighter pilots, inverted commas, and those who were more stable, suitable for the bomber,
How did they choose between it?
Well, that the assessment initially recommended you for A, fighter training, or B, multi-engine.
And which were you?
Well, I was selected for multi-engine training. I suppose probably because of my background, basically, actually. But anyway, it didn't matter. But there we were. We were split into these two components. And there was a third element of the flying training school, which was the advanced training. Now, the theory was that we would do 6 months there. We'd do 3 months on the intermediate, and the second 3 months, you've moved up a grade. flying the same aircraft, but they were going to have hang bombs on them and give you real live ammunition to drop, to use. So to cut the long story short, we used to fly basically from early morning, when I say early morning, early breakfast was 3 o'clock in the morning, and you were down to the flights by 8. And the first, you flew from about 8 to 1, and then you got your got your head down because it was so hot in the afternoon, and then you went back in the evening after about 4 or 5 or 6 o'clock, and you flew through the night flying element. That was the sort of general. My course, which was number 6 war course, arrived at Habania, the 18 guys from Kenya were grouped with a few guys from South Africa and Indian Air Force and one or two other people. So the course, I think, was about 36 strong, but they didn't all survive and they didn't all pass out. So that was, I've got a picture that I can soon count them, of the course. But the first thing you did was you were introduced to a flying instructor. No, I should tell you, I said we started flying. We did, sometimes half of the course alternated between flying in the morning and ground school for the first few months. Those who went early flying and we went to ground school for the same period. The ground school was amplifying what we, weapons and radio signals. You had to turn up on your Morse code. You had to reach a standard of 12 words a minute was the required standard. Some guys could. One guy on our course who was an ex-post office, direct entry from recruit, he was ex-post office. He had 24 words a minute, phenomenal. even better than some of the instructors. But at 4 FTS, we started flying on January the 23rd. So from December the 30th to January 23rd, we'd been in transit from, there was a little break at Christmas and New Year, but I piled up with one of the local guys who was resident, had been recruited. I spent Christmas with them, very nice family actually. Their parents, the father was worked in the civil service, it was all the self-governing in them. But we did, and then we all embarked and came up. So the first trip I had, had with the 4 FTS was with in Oxford. Flight Lieutenant May took me up for my first trip, and then subsequently that was for 40 minutes, the usual thing, familiarity with the cockpit layout, new aircraft, two engines, effect of the controls, taxiing, straight and level flight, climbing, gliding and stalling, and medium turns. That was my first 40 minutes. It was done mainly by the instructor, basically. And then that was threatened May. I think it must have been the flight commander. Anyway, I was then allocated to a flight sergeant, Barnes, who was an incredible guy. And he taught me right through to January, from the 23rd of January to gone February. We weren't there all that long. End of February, and he was still going in March.
Now, what was he teaching you?
Well, he was teaching me how to fly in Oxford. We were going through the same drill. Mark, I'm just going to, just to get the area, because I reason he, Barnes, March 28th, that was it. March the 28th. So from January the 23rd to March the 28th, he was my instructor.
And he
taught me how to fly an Oxford.
Now, what was there to learn? What was the Oxford like, firstly?
Well, first of all, it was an old wooden aircraft. It was a big aircraft, physically big. It had two engines, and therefore everything had to control two engines as opposed to one. The speeds of takeoff and landing were different, but you still had retractable undercarriage, you had flaps. We didn't have any variable pitch to control these bays. But you had all the cockpit drill to remember, you know, the trim and the mixture and so on, which was part of the learning curve, because the same mnemonics, is that right, mnemonics, which you used then were used subsequently in service aircraft, like TMPFF, trim mixture, pitch flaps and fuel, that type of thing. But we didn't have any pitch, so that was, but it was, I'm just looking down. They're concentrated, taking off into wind, of course, that's always a good thing to do. power approach and landing, that's also quite reasonable. And then there was asymmetric flying on one engine. This was the first thing this guy did to me. The first trip Barnes took me on, I haven't got it mentioned here. It says, but he said, right, I said, he showed me how to take off. He says, take off. And I was taken off for this for the very, very first time. He took off and he cut the starboard engine, just throttled it back. He said, no, go back and land. And it was a starboard, which is a right-hand circuit, cut the starboard engine. So there was I, struggling to maintain height on one engine. Second trip in Oxford. Anyway, I didn't actually make it. I made it back to the downwind leg, but I was in a bit of a low altitude at that time, and he said, I got it. And he took it in and landed it. And then he sort of got through the paddle, the patter, and told me what I had to do and what I shouldn't do, and so on.
What was the art of flying on one engine? What do you do when you're flying on one engine that's different?
I suppose gentle turns. It depends on the aircraft. Gentle turns. The Oxford was all right, really. Once you got, I mean, we did it solo afterwards. So we did it as a matter of course. And it was just a question of having the height and knowing. I mean, when it's the first time, it was a bit disconcerting. But after your initial attempt, and his main argument was, well, it can be done. You did it, which is true. I got almost there, but he said, well, you know, you'll get that with experience. That was the patter. What else did we do? Low flying, action in the event of a fire. Now we know, shutting engines, switching off, banding aircraft. These are things that they taught in the very, very early stages of the. I went on the first solo. I didn't have many hours on the Oxford. Well, a few. I suppose it's registered here somewhere. Don't seem to have it.
Doesn't matter too much.
I don't seem to have it without counting them up. It wasn't very many hours. I mean, it was on February the 1st, so it was only.
Anything about your first solo flight in the Oxford, or was it?
I didn't find it. That was from January the 23rd to. Well, that was only. The first solo was on the February the 1st, so that was, what, 8 days? So it couldn't have been more than about 6 hours. So I found it was great, because it was another new aircraft. I mean, two engines to play with. The technique of manipulating the throttles was the thing which came. You eventually established to have to walk the throttles, you know, up, so you didn't induce a swing, which was easy to do. But the point about the Oxford was that they were pretty old aircraft, and in the flying of them, when you were on the early morning shift, the dampness had made them stiff. The controls were stiff. As the temperature increased through the day, the controls became very sloppy. That's the only best way I could